Hello. Welcome to Taldman's Words with Sam and Scott. Sans Emily Burke, who Sam is a super fan of, and I am a super, super, super fan of. I'm very, very happy that Sam's here. He lives in the Empire State that Alicia Keys made famous, and he's here now in beautiful LA, bringing some semi-dreary 62-degree Fahrenheit weather here. Not stoked about that, but it's just really awesome to have someone who is a peer that I look up to and just a nice, sincere guy, like separate from music and everything else, cares about people, cares about artists, cares about other managers to the point of, I guess, kind of being like a non-attorney Donald Passman giving advice. And I appreciate it. I guess the terminology he uses is teachable moment. And he's actually taking a picture of me now, and I'm so scared. But we're here. Sam Tall is in the building, is in the room. Just took him to the roof. And in addition to working with this really, really great band, Valley, out of Canada, who you might hear about in 2019 or now, he does so many things for so many people and so many windows that he is under. So bless up. Sam Tall's in the building. Today is actually just before Thanksgiving, but by the time this episode airs, it will either be around Christmas time or even possibly in 2019. I'm actually going to New York in a few days with my wife to see my family, and it's going to be good. And right when I get back, we're pretty much booked out for the duration of the year. So thank you guys so much for tuning in to Walden's Words this year. Every single Tuesday, 5 o'clock Pacific time, which is my time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, which is NYU time, the show airs. In addition, not subtraction, Sunday mornings, bright and early, 5 a.m. Pacific time, which if you're a student or a youngin' listening to that, that might be when you get back from the club, know what I'm saying? Or 8 a.m., which is what I wake up now as an old man. You know, my back hurts, my neck hurts. I'm not as tall as I used to be. And you can go on adobe.com, stream every single episode. Go ham. It's free. You can also go on the iTunes podcast app, subscribe every single episode. We're in, I believe, the 110s right now. So, two words, fuck yeah. Stick around, Waldman's Words, Sam Tall. You're going to learn a lot. I'm going to learn a lot more. And if you look into his phone right now, there's a picture of me. Muhaha. All right, so we have Sam in the Tall Park in this room right now. If you listened to the intro, you learned a little bit. If you listened post the intro, you heard a few songs or a few commercials, but fuck that, Sam's here. Welcome.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I love it.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
You are my little matcha. So you're out in Los Angeles. We're gonna kind of go non-sequentially for a bit. How's your trip been so far?
So far, so good. I mean, right now, it's a little bit before Thanksgiving. It's snowing in New York for the first time of the season, and I'm so glad not to be in it.
You're wearing a fucking t-shirt.
I'm wearing a t-shirt and no jacket, and that's like, I've been wearing coats for weeks, and it's I don't even have to bring one with me here. That's amazing.
I mean, but there's plenty of people here that do. It's kind of funny because the kids, when it's like 62 degrees like today, are wearing like poofy North Face jackets. They're wearing skis. They don't even know how to handle the weather.
As soon as I saw that it was above 60 degrees, I'm like, I don't need a jacket today at all. And everybody's like, oh, it's chilly.
No. Oh my God, it's so brisk. And when there's like a little bit of rainfall,
tropical storm alert,
like the people in LA are crazy. But I'm one of them.
I think it rained for several days in New York, which is, you know, not a curse to complain about being in California.
When there's a drought.
No kidding. And we're just like, yeah, rain boots. We're fine. The end.
You guys have been through far worse. So tell me about what it was like growing up and what got you into music, because honestly, I don't know too much pre-NYU, so I'm going to learn a lot right now.
I basically came out of the womb playing music. That was kind of a thing that my mom liked to tell me a lot was, I was always a rhythmic kicker in the womb. Some of my earliest memories are literally sitting on the piano bench trying to pluck out.
Kicking memories, or like, is that what
like being 3 or 4 years old.
Okay, that, I was like, that, I just went.
My memories go all the way prenatal.
That's fine. I mean, some people know a lot more, and some people bullshit.
I have visual memories of like being super small and sitting on the piano bench and trying to figure out how to make good sounds.
Where was this, by the way? Where
just did in you my grow? House?
No, no, but city, state, zip code.
It was in Montclair, New Jersey.
Damn right.
I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey until I was about 15. And that's where I learned to play piano. I started playing saxophone when I was in third grade.
Did your parents encourage that, or was that on your
own? I chose a saxophone. The piano was encouraged by the parents.
I recommend that.
Absolutely. I think it's a great starting place because you can't really fuck up the intonation.
You really can't unless it's out of tune. But like, I'm looking away. No, I wish my parents encouraged me to play piano. They just encouraged me to leave the house so that they can enjoy themselves.
Yeah. In school, in elementary school, they, you know, did this sort of demonstration of all these different instruments. And one of the ones that I thought was super cool was a saxophone. And so the two music teachers at my school could play a whole range of instruments. One was sort of woodwind focused, and one was sort of brass focused. So we, you know, French horn and trumpet and flute and clarinet and, you know, a little guitar and drums and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, saxophone, that's the thing that's gravitating alto. Me. It's pulling me right now. So at that time, because of the size of an 8-year-old human, alto saxophone.
You weren't playing Barry sax when you were 8?
Definitely not.
It'd be bigger than you.
Yeah. And so I did that. And then sometime in middle school, I made some friends who were super into like Nirvana and Radiohead and things like that. And that wasn't ever music that I was really listening to at the time. Like, I had just kind of found out about Green Day with the arrival of American Idiot. And that was like the first thing that I heard, just like, oh, this is like modern rock music. Okay, cool. And before that, it was, you know, like, I just get whatever CDs were in the car. Now that's what I call music, what number whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean were those CDs that your parents had in the car?
Yeah, like anything that you can
your
pick
up. Your parents
were
hip, though. They had now. My mom was listening to Barbara Streisand, and my dad was listening to classic rock. Not to talk smack on those, but your parents were listening to some modern stuff?
Well, so my...
I've never heard anyone say that.
My dad's super into like Zeppelin and Bob Dylan and Beatles, and so all of his records are on the shelf. And my mom has always been into music of the day. And so when she was a kid, she was listening to Styx and Yes and Police and things like that. And so all of those records are on the shelf. And I had those in my room as a kid because I just kind of took them out of like wherever they kept the record collection just on display. And I actually went and listened to stuff and used it and loved those records. But her taste has always been just kind of whatever's modern. And so...
So is she listening to like mumble rap right now?
Not quite. But in the car on the way to school most days... we'd be listening to WPLJ, 95.5, New York, New Jersey.
I'm from Long Island. And, I'm nodding.
And at the time, late 90s, I was born in 92. Mm-hmm. Late 90s, early 2000s, being driven to school, that's a lot of like singer-songwriter stuff. Late 90s rock.
I'm trying to think, wait, late 90s, like, would you say that that was like Sheryl Crow we'd and go Jewel like, and Sarah McLachlan? Like that kind of stuff?
Almost like Sixpence and then into like John Mayer.
Okay.
And PLJ's tagline was all the hits without the rap, which is like a very strange tagline and very much like a late 90s kind of thing to say.
It's kind of...
you would never say that.
Well, a lot of people used to say fuck disco like around that time. And the cliched answer whenever I talk to someone that I can't stand is, oh, what do you like to listen to? Everything but country and rap.
Yeah.
That's like garbage. Most narrow-minded bullshit.
Totally. And
yeah, so that's, we agree.
So this kind of like this pop radio station was like very much like hot AC. And so I was listening to a lot of stuff that came out of that. And mm-hmm. and still like I'm not like a frequent listener of the that sort of era and that sort of genre. But every time that it comes on a Spotify playlist or something like that, I kind of flash back a little bit and feel like a kid again.
Well, it's what
like,
you grew up on.
It's very nice to have those kind of sounds, like all that like late 90s.
I don't seek out Cherry Pop and Daddies or no. Brian Setzer Orchestra, but I remember there was a year when you couldn't escape the swing.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of like the more like the casual singer-songwriter stuff would end up on like Radio Disney. And so we would obviously listen when it wasn't about PLJ for mom, it was about Radio Disney for the kids. And Radio Disney also had compilation discs. And go with me here because you're going to love this. Radio Disney had compilation discs that were kind of like the Now series. Mm-hmm. And so we had like three or four volumes of these Radio Disney compilations. And on one of these, I think it was volume two.
Wait a second. Can I guess that Yellow Card was on it?
Possibly, but that's not where I'm going with this. Where I'm going with this is Yoda by Weird Al.
Oh, shit.
Was on, I believe it was either Yoda or it was...
That's how you learned about the Kinks, I bet.
Well, I mean, I learned actually learned about a lot of music from Weird Al parodies.
Oh my God!
It was either
you told me about Motley Crue.
What was the Star Wars Episode One song they did? What was it called?
Oh, the one that was American Pie
parody.
And so it was either bye, this here Anakin guy.
It was either that or Yoda, and I thought it was so clever. I didn't know what it was that I was hearing and enjoying, but I thought it was so clever and. I begged and pleaded to hear that all the time. And then I met a friend one summer who had just gotten his hands on, like, I think MP3s had just started getting shared around the internet. And
like Napster era?
Yeah, and we were like 10 or 11 years old, and he introduced me to Amish Paradise.
On the record Bad Hair Day.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I saw Weird Al in concert my freshman year of college at Michigan. So good.
Oh my gosh. So... This is really formative for my musical background.
I mean, parodies changed my life.
The ability to write and be smart and be funny at the same
clever.
Time.
Clever.
And be able to execute the song that well. And so I heard Amish Paradise. I thought, this is hilarious. I don't even know the origin of the song. Most of the songs, I didn't know the origin of them at all. I just knew
the
Weird Al
version. The origin of the song, speaking of the etymology of that, is actually Stevie Wonder.
That's right.
Pastime Paradise. I didn't know that. I heard Gangsta's Paradise. And
again, like that's you go down the rabbit hole with these things, and that's how you learn a lot about.
And this is pre like internet searching. Yeah. What's the internet?
Well, and so he introduced me to that song, and I said, I got to find what CD that's on. And so I'm just, looking everywhere I can, going to a local CD shop, trying to find this Weird Al disc. And they had some, but not all of them. And then I found out that Running with Scissors was coming out. And I said, Mom, I need to have this CD. I have to get it. And so we pre-ordered Running with Scissors. So I had basically...
Wait, pre-ordered it like for mail order or at a record store?
Well, we went to a record store and they said, we can put in the pre-order for it and ship it to you.
Oh, have cool.
Have it shipped to you. And so that was...
Cut the middleman.
That was perfect. And so like they mail ordered some stuff to the store for me to pick up. Like, they didn't have Bad Hair Day, but I wanted it so badly because I had Amish Paradise. And
obvi.
So I went and picked it up like a week later. Then Running with Scissors, I like pre-ordered that. And I listened to that constantly. And so...
His original songs, by the way, the ones that like are kind of like homages to like Beach Boys or whatever, are just as good. Weird Al is such a powerful force with kids.
Yeah, and that's what's crazy is like... Most, and I'm sure this is very deliberate on his part, the music is so acceptable for a broad range, and you can think it's fun and interesting when you're a kid, you can think it's smart and funny when you're an adult.
It's like Shrek.
It's got layers, right? And yeah, like Shrek.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's jokes that the kids won't get, but they definitely won't be cognizant of it, that the
for
adults
sure.
are laughing, and then there's stupid fart
or
food
like,
jokes.
Like old Nicktoons that are like great for kids,
Ren
and then
and
the parents can just sit there. Well, Ren and Stimpy's an edge case.
It's dark. But like, no, Rugrats.
Rugrats has some parent jokes in it and that just go over the heads of kids.
Over Phil and Lil's heads.
Yeah. And so at the time, it's just like a lot of Green Day. I downloaded basically every one of their records on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for purchasing music.
Yeah. Like 2004, I guess. And then I bought a lot of Weird Al CDs. And then I listened to a lot of Zeppelin and Beatles vinyl. That was like...
You're running the
pre-teen.
Gamut.
And that was the shift where I went from playing jazz saxophone to playing guitar and started writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved.
What year was this? Because American Idiot was 2004. So what year was this?
So I was in sixth grade.
Okay.
And so that's when that all kind of happened. And I found like one friend in middle school, it was a small middle school, and the two of us just loved Weird Al. But we also really liked current rock music at the time, and then some of our other friends were getting really into like Good Charlotte and System of a Down.
Mm-hmm. It was a good time for
My
music.
Chemical Romance was happening right around there, and so that was the kind of stuff that was like I wasn't ever super passionate about it. I wasn't into the emo scene, but my friends were, and so by association, it was
music
that I knew
about. Well, you lived in Jersey. You kind of are literally connected to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was very, very local and very personal for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And especially at that age, it's very impactful to have somebody kind of sing about feeling very weird.
Well, that's what I was thinking when, like, you're listening to Green Day. Green Day was kind of like, fuck the establishment, especially with American Idiot. Yeah. And what 12, 13-year-old boy doesn't identify with that?
When all you know in a liberal town in New Jersey that, like, oh, George W. Bush is ruining everything, mm-hmm. Green Day is saving us from that by singing about it. Cool, I'm going to do that.
Literally the title track.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you believe what you're told. At that age.
We had that conversation in the car.
And so that's kind of what I believed was like the stuff that my friends were telling me, what their parents were telling them. And it just, you know, it's a little bit of a bubble that way. But at that age, you don't really have anything else going. Mm-hmm. I moved to Texas at the end of ninth grade. So I left New Jersey, moved to Texas.
But I just have a question about Jersey quickly, because you said Montclair. I never knew you were from there. Is there a famous school called Montclair Prep? Or am I out of my mind? Because I've heard that name a bunch.
I don't think there's a Montclair Prep. There's a Montclair Kimberly Academy, and then there's Montclair High School, which is where I went.
That's the public one?
Yeah.
Is the other one?
There's just one public high school and then one private high school.
Okay, cool. Anyway,
it's
Texas.
It's a very small town. And so I went from this big high school, like 2,000 kids at Montclair High School, like 300 or 400 kids. No, like 200 kids at the middle school I went to like 2,000 kids at the high school, mm-hmm. and started playing in a band on guitar, which I'd been playing for a couple of years at that point.
What style of music was it?
All like basement rock.
Okay.
Yeah, like really kind of just trying to be loud. And I was playing sax and jazz band, had at that point switched to tenor because nobody was playing tenor, so it was easier to get first chair.
Lend me a tenor.
And then I moved to Texas, and the school systems are so different.
Well, they revolve around high school football, right?
Right. And so basically got put into a private school because the public school options just weren't quite as good as in New Jersey at the time.
What city in Texas?
In Fort Worth. I moved to Fort Worth. And back to a small school, like 400 kids down from 2,000. So the talent pool is really small because it's just like sort of the ratio of, you know, if you get 2% of student body is going to be talented at music, well, 2% is objectively a much smaller number when it's 400 people. And so the school band was a lot lower. I just say, like, it wasn't as innately talented because the kids didn't have the need to. It was like a class that they got to take. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they had chosen to take band because they really wanted to be in band.
Some communities are very, very into promoting the arts.
Yeah.
And I could tell you my hometown of Long Island was huge on it. And when I went to Michigan, which is kind of the opposite of your story. It was my graduating class was around like 400 to 500, but in Michigan, the student body was 36,000.
Oh, wow.
So I assumed that like in my dorm, I would have so many people to play with. I found one.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
But sometimes I mean, you never I guess know. You really never know. But I mean, I don't know too much about the Fort Worth music scene, nor do I know about their orchestral scenes.
Well, so this is what kind of drove me to where I am is like, leaving.
Well, I drove you to where you are.
That's very true. Physically.
Yes. We don't deal with metaphors here.
No metaphors at all. I was in a band and I just started making friends in New Jersey and then immediately got uprooted. And by virtue of like not having any of my friends around to play music with, and by virtue of the fact that like Fort Worth is a massive town. Mm-hmm. It's like 26 miles
Dallas
across.
Is freaking huge.
And then Montclair is 6 miles long by 1 mile wide. So to go from Montclair, which is tiny, to Fort Worth, which is it takes literally an hour to drive across the town, mm-hmm. not even to get over to Dallas. And then, so it's just like the logistics of doing anything of that nature was very hard. And so I spent
everything's bigger in Texas.
Exactly. Well, yeah, everything. And so I spent a lot more time isolated in my bedroom playing guitar for myself and started writing songs a lot more mm-hmm. than just playing with people who could write. I started writing a lot more.
More music or more lyrics? Like more like sad, feeling alone lyrics? Like that kind of stuff?
A combination. It wasn't exclusively like sad and alone, like emo songs. But it was just like kind of exploring my capacities as a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. It was okay. I think I wrote some good stuff, nothing great. Being young and all, but some people are preternaturally talented in that way, and I wasn't one of them. Very adept at picking up the instrument, but and really into poetry and lyrics at the time, and just but it just kind of wasn't It was the thing that motivated me to get through high school, but it wasn't the thing that I was like going to do forever.
Did you intersperse kind of saxophone melody and harmony type stuff with it, or were you just thinking more
sometimes
of a rocker?
I would like I had GarageBand, and then I got Logic on an iMac, and I started like making music in my room was the most impactful thing I could possibly have done, and like learning how to produce myself and how to record in my closet. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing.
The sax is coming back, dude.
Hey, man, it's a cool, it's a really cool instrument, and I kind of wish I never like really put it down. Mm-hmm. I went to NYU after I like.
Well, but just tell me more about Texas, though, because we can get into New York and where you are now in the next segment. But because you moved there and you're writing songs, but were you playing gigs? Were you playing in bands? And how was the school system for you there?
School was academically rigorous, the one that I was in. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't great because I have never been like a really strong academic, but.
I don't believe you.
I pick up really well in the things that I love, and I just can't be bothered with the things that don't just resonate with me.
Well, then buy the commercials. You have ADD. Have you ever had trouble focusing on something that didn't interest you?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's just...
like chemistry and biology and all that kind of stuff. I was never really into.
I couldn't get into science. I just couldn't.
Like, so. I think it's very fascinating, and like now that there's things that I enjoy about it and things that I'm curious about. I will sink my teeth into a Wikipedia article for hours. Mm-hmm. But at the time, because it was like assigned and a requirement and it wasn't what I was interested in at the time, I didn't really pick up on it. Mm-hmm. And like the number of books that were assigned reading that I never read because they were requirements and somebody made me do it. I'm like, I don't want to. But now I really want to go back and read all that stuff because it's great literature. Things like that was kind of my school experience. And eventually, I did find a couple of friends who could play music and were into making some rock music. My little brother had started playing drums. And so what we basically did was...
Did he have a kit at home?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
He had a drum kit and I had a guitar.
So you had a studio, man.
And then a friend of ours also played guitar. And so we started this three-piece rock band. And
sans bass?
Well, no. So we would switch guitar and bass. Me and the other guitar player would, depending on who wrote the song, they would get to play guitar and sing. Mm-hmm. And so we started playing some gigs locally and but in the middle of the set would switch sides mm-hmm. and switch instruments.
Oh, you'd switch even sides? Okay.
Which really, yep. which, you know, now that I know what I know, that's terrible for front of house.
Well, for the momentum too.
But yeah. But it was just like, that was kind of our gimmick.
My band in college did it too, Blue Delusion. But we would, yeah. switch it up, and usually the guitar player was the one who sang.
Right.
That's just it.
That's just how it is. And
tell that to Paul McCartney.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I think there was like one song where I sang and played bass.
Tell that to Sting. Yeah. I'm just going to...
when you're up there and you're doing it, you kind of like, yeah, maybe Sting's got it right. This is a lot easier than trying to play guitar the whole time.
It is, especially if you're concentrating purely on root notes. But let's wrap this little segment up, and then we'll go into part deux, but... So you're playing in... What was the name of this band? And why didn't you win a Grammy?
The name of the band was called Albatross.
Okay.
We found out at some point that there's a band in the Middle East called Albatross that was much more famous.
You didn't call yourselves Albatross 182 as a result of that?
No.
or some kind of modern spelling like Albatross.
No, we weren't clever enough for that when we were 16, 17. We just recorded in our bedroom or in the basement or whatever, and then just shared it with our friends at school, burned it onto CDRs and handed it out to people and said, please come to our show at this like divey all ages space. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And like that's how we kind of figured out how to
take flight.
Take flight. Make music, get out into the world, and start like thinking about it as more than just playing music, but actually being a little commercial about it.
Well, that's a really good way to wrap this segment up, and then we'll go into your New York / management journey. But if you can give me an adjective, because you tune into this show, you've told me this several times, at least once or twice, what adjective would you use to describe this segment? Because I will call it, I guess, a combination like relaxed yet caffeinated.
Oh, very caffeinated. This caffeine is hitting my bloodstream as we speak.
Well, I haven't noticed it, but it's all good. So enjoy these songs or these ads or your bathroom break and stick around for segment two of Taldman's Words. So I just told this to Sam, but he's actually going to be put to work immediately after this doing another interview. So he's been bitching and complaining this entire commercial break. Actually, he hasn't. He's happy. So, Sam, you're back. Tell me about what drew you to NYU? Because you grew up east, then you almost moved as far west as you can get, and then you're like, I'm going to go back east.
Like growing up outside of New York, and my dad worked in the city, commuted a lot, very bridge and tunnel. And so
just Long Island, bro, B&T.
Visiting, visiting the city as a kid, you know, it's impactful and it you know, sets a sort of tone for what you expect the real world to be. And you go someplace so radically different where it's just rolling hills, low skylines and lots of big houses because they have the space. And you're like, oh, this is so vastly different. And it's kind of strange to me. The place was not my favorite, Texas. The people were lovely, and I met some of my favorite people in the world. A lot of formative experiences as a teenager, you know, 16, 17, and 18 years old in Texas. But I could not wait to get back and to the place that really felt like home to me. And
Montclair, Montclair, Montclair.
I did visit Montclair a couple of times when I was doing, like, college visits. And
are there any universities close to it?
Well, there's Montclair State University.
That's probably what I was thinking of. Okay.
And but other than that, I mean, there's like William Patterson is in the area.
Okay.
I'm sure there's some schools in Newark. But it was just like every time that I would go back.
School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah. Even still, like living in New York, sometimes if there's like a good occasion, I'll like take the train or the bus or even just, you know, drive.
Or bird.
You can't bird over the bridge.
But you can burn a bridge.
You can, indeed. I hope not, never to do that again.
You never know. Always time.
There's always time. Take the train, take the bus, rent a car maybe, and drive over to Montclair and just kind of like steep in these childhood memories. It just kind of feels good because it's a nice, small, quaint little town.
Is it like about 45 minutes outside of Manhattan?
Something like that, yeah.
We're the opposite.
Yeah, it's a commutable kind of thing where it's like it takes forever, but it's only like 10 or 12 miles, you know, because New York traffic.
You mean like driving in L.A.?
I can't drive here. Just
no, you need to always assume when you leave the house that there's a fire on the 405 or a president's in town or like there's a big audition. And then you won't be late.
Exactly. And so at the time, I guess when I was in 11th grade and thinking about college, I was like, I want to go someplace around New York. I want to study music, but I don't necessarily know that I want to study like music composition. Mm-hmm. I know that if I go for like guitar performance or saxophone performance, I'm going to spend a lot of time in the practice room. And what I don't like to do is shed like that. It just doesn't appeal to me. And it's like, if you can't find pleasure in the workshopping of your craft like that,
why are you doing it?
You cannot be the best at that. So a friend of mine was going to go to NYU for acting. And there's like only two kids that I had ever known from this school that had gone to NYU. Most of them went to UT, Texas A&M, Texas Tech. And when she told me, she's like, they have this music business program that I heard about. I don't know exactly anything about it, but you should look into it. And I went online and I was reading about the music business program at NYU Steinhardt. And I'm like, that's it. That's everything that I want to know. How do record labels work? Because I'm in a band and I wish I knew how record labels work. How does concert management work? Because we really want to tour.
Was it a new program when you were doing it? Because like,
it's been around since the 80s.
Well, my father didn't want me to go to any school in New York City, but I mean, I'm sure if I was in high school and I knew about a program like that, I would have been ham about it, but I never heard of any programs like that.
And well, at the time, so this was like 2009.
Way before like Full Sail.
Fall of 2009 was the beginning of my 12th grade year. And that's when I was doing like early applications to college and stuff. And at the time, it was one of like four or five reputable programs. It was that, USC, but I didn't really want to go to school out here. I really wanted to be in an urban environment like New York City.
Because like there's definitely no spoiled people at NYU.
No.
Like USC like just has that market cornered.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And there's definitely no Trustafarians in New York City. Anyway.
Never. It was either that or like Drexel in Philly.
Emily. Emily goes there.
And Drexel was like a really cool option, and I had friends that went to UPenn, so it was like right across the street. I didn't feel like the right kind of calling from Drexel, but NYU just like felt really naturally like a place I needed to be. I applied early decision, and I kind of had this idea that I was going to go and be a musician who couldn't get screwed by the industry. I was going to be so armed with information that, like, if I wanted to be DIY, it wouldn't be just like scrappy and
tools.
Fighting. I would be able to do it the way that the big people do, but do it by myself. I got
the big people of Texas or the big wigs,
the big wigs of the industry. Okay. Like, I know how labels work. I can run my own label.
Have you
I know how
there's
booking
that many
works.
Fat people out here. Anyway,
I don't know what that means.
What it means is that people are vain. Anyway, so you went for self-protection.
I went for, like, you know, if I'm ever going to make it as a musician or as a songwriter, I need to know all the stuff, which I believe artists and songwriters need to know all the stuff.
Especially
absolutely.
Now.
Yeah. More and more. And what ended up happening was I got in, and when I went—
Is it a small concentrate program? Like, do you have to apply specifically for that program?
Yeah. Okay. And so to know that you want to do that at 17 or 18 years old is insane. They tried to promote this idea of, like, they think that students should take a gap year because you really need to know who you are. But I'd spent basically 3 years in Texas.
Wait, NYU does that?
And, well, yeah. So the program director at the time was like, she's like, you know— I tell parents this all the time. If I really had my way, I would advise all students to take a gap year because you learn a lot about yourself before coming here. And you can apply and then defer attendance until the following year.
I've never heard a private institution where they need the money encouraging.
Well,
that's
NYU
awesome.
Doesn't need the money.
You know what I mean. You don't have to yell at me. Don't get smart. No. But basically, it's usually they encourage you to go right away. That's awesome. That's
yeah,
extremely
man.
Different.
And
I love NY.
So when I got there,
and what year was this?
Fall of 2010. Right
Thanks
away,
Obama.
Yeah, right at the beginning of the first course in music business that we were required to take was a class called Business Structure of the Music Industry, and it was a fundamentals class: how do record labels work? What are royalties? What is a mechanical? What is a PRO? What does an agent do?
Can you tell me how they work? What is a PRO and what an agent does? Actually, we could save that for part
two. That's a compendium of episodes.
Yes. Compilation of tall episodes.
Yeah. Hey, I'm here for it. I realized within weeks, like, I've spent the past 3 years of my life holed up in my room recording myself and then eventually, like, finding a small band to play in and booking some shows locally. That's the business. I can do that. I have friends here in New York who can't do that. They're more talented than I am at music. I'm much better than them at this.
It's maybe good that I can you help knew them. That early. I wish a lot of musicians were self-aware.
Well, and I think it's just like realizing that something's driving you. And I was so driven to play music, write music, produce music, make records. To this day, I still really get a great kick out of getting in the weeds on producing or mixing something, even though it's not something I do professionally.
But recreationally.
Yeah, like, you know, tweaking a mix is fun because I think I can hear what makes it better.
But and there's just, less pressure.
It feels like I'm doing something, but it's not right. There's not a professional demand. Mm-hmm. So it's a hobby. It's a fun little hobby that I get to do. It's a weird hobby, but it's a fun one.
I can think of weirder ones. There's people that collect, like, petrified poop.
Mm-mm.
Yes, there are.
No, thank you.
I'm going to Google it.
Please don't.
Okay, fine.
I
don't want to infect the Adobe computers.
No. And so I at the same time that I was realizing this, I was also learning about the existence of Rick Rubin.
He went to my high school?
Well, he went to NYU.
Oh, my God. So both of us are, I'm Rick and you're Rubin. You're the most Jewish one in this room. It's great.
So he started Def Jam out of his dorm room at NYU.
It's insane.
I'm thinking, like, hey, if he can do it, so can I. That's a totally false assumption, but it was one that I made as a college freshman. And
Run DMC and BC
hey,
Boys.
Man.
That's
so
insane.
I thought, like, hey, maybe I can try this out. And so I started recording people. I brought my recording equipment from Texas to my dorm at NYU. I had my speakers. I had a microphone. I had, you know, interface in my laptop. That's all you need. And so I started recording people in the practice rooms or in my dorm and making some music. And it wasn't great, and it didn't really sell anything, but it was a fun try. So I basically had started this record label, and after about a year of trying, realizing, like, this takes money to market records, and if you want to use an actual studio and hire an actual mix engineer to do it better, that costs money. And I can't make all the records, but I want to put out all the records, and I don't know that I can afford to do this. I worked a summer job after the freshman year.
In Manhattan? Or
in, I went back to, my family still lived in Texas at the time. So after freshman year of college, I went back to Texas and I waited tables at, like,
morning
till night. Yeah, you learn so much about how to like actually work hard and how to treat people and how to be treated by people and how to, you know,
retail not take and restaurant personally. Work, everything. Mm-hmm.
And I worked as many double shifts as I could. I like worked really hard to put tips together. You know, Texas obviously plays to the federal minimum wage and not a state minimum wage, so making like dirt money, but relying on tips entirely.
But no expenses. You were
living at home. Yep. Yeah. And all of that money. All of it went to, like, 8 weeks worth of waiting tables went to making a record with this band in Texas.
Oh, with double shifts, that's a lot of money.
This, like, funky, groovy band from UNT, which has a phenomenal jazz program. So sort of like a band that in a future life could have been Snarky Puppy, but they were way too early and not nearly quite as talented. And
You don't have to, like, cut down their tree to make your tree bigger.
Snarky Puppy's amazing.
No, I'm talking about this band, the Sam Tall Worship Project.
They were really cool guys and just wanted to make a record, and none of us knew what we were doing. And so I just sunk a whole bunch of money into it that I had made that summer, and it didn't move the needle at all. Nobody really cared, and that was partly because we didn't realize, like, oh, you need a marketing budget. You can't just spend all your money on a record and not have a marketing budget.
I just want to digress for a minute, but it's not really digression or regression or aggression. But if you're listening and you're a DIY artist, if you are spending $5,000, which is not that much, on an LP,
it's about what we spent on that.
Well, and that was years ago.
Yeah.
Have a budget for advertising/marketing.
Yep.
That's equivalent. Otherwise, your money is going to be spent for you and your friends to listen to your product. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it becomes an expensive hobby at that point.
You're doing exactly what you're doing now for fun. If you want to do it for fun, fuck it. Don't have a marketing budget.
Right.
Pull out all the stops on your own. But if you expect it or want it to go somewhere, do that. Anyway, back to you. And I know you agree.
Yeah, absolutely. It was right after that. A friend of mine from a music camp that I went to as a kid, who had pursued a career as a singer-songwriter, was starting to get some buzz locally and was starting to go play at some schools, like colleges were booking him, and was on Facebook kind of like lamenting how difficult it is to be a DIY artist, and especially in like 2011, like right after Spotify had just hit U.S. shores. So that like streaming wasn't a thing, and there wasn't really algorithms to serve your music to the world. Very much still
MySpace pages.
It's like the end of MySpace and right into like Facebook. Mm-hmm. Instagram hadn't really become a platform for marketing. It was still kind of this, like, I think it was just starting to take off as this like kitschy hipster social app. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of the tools that we rely on so much now that actually make it really easy to get started, even if it's really hard to break through the noise, those didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so still very scrappy DIY. 2011 still felt like, you know, the mid-2000s in that sort of punk, late punk ethos. And he's like, it's just so hard and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't know how to like grow this and get better and move up. And I said, listen, I'm going to school for this. I've done 1 year, and I'm about to go back for this my second year. I don't know really how management works, but it sounds, from what I know from the books, it sounds like you need a manager. And I know some of this information, and I'm learning more every day. I'll come help you. Like, let's do this on a trial basis. I don't know how we should strike any kind of agreement, but let's just do it on a trial basis and see what happens.
Did you realize this as you were saying it, or was this a planned interaction?
No, it was literally like I saw him talking about this on Facebook and I said, man, I can help. Wow. I didn't think that I would. Yeah, I can help this guy.
Similar to how I got started.
And I was like, running this record label is costing a lot of money and managing costs nothing.
But time.
But time and commitment and trust and loyalty. And I can do that. He's been my friend for years. I can do that. And so that was the first artist I ever managed. His name is Ryan Quesada. He's still out there doing a great job. I worked with him for like 4 years.
Concurrently with school and a little bit post.
Concurrently with school, a little bit post, concurrently with...
It's a good album name, by the way.
Concurrently with school.
And a little bit
a
post.
A little bit post. But, you know, working with other artists along the way. I interned at Downtown Publishing while I was at NYU. still managing Ryan, still, you know, working with other artists along the way that unfortunately never made it. But, you know, it's early enough that it doesn't make a huge difference. You're mm-hmm. still kind of learning. And so that was kind of how I like fell into management. And so for like 3 years in college, I was actively managing artists while going to class. And
but I would say that you would have a lot more to offer your student body and teachers because you were actually like working the field.
So that was a big part of it, was like a lot of my classmates at NYU were very smart and very academically focused. And it's a tough school by any account. And they were picking up the knowledge and waiting for it to apply. One day you'll have an internship and you'll have to deploy this knowledge. One day you're going to graduate and you're going to have this knowledge and you're going to go find a job and you're mm-hmm. going to have to use it. And I literally every day after a class, I would text Ryan or I would text one of the other artists I was working with, or I'd text a friend who is like an artist or working with
an
artist.
We didn't have text messaging when I was in college. Continue.
And I just say like, I literally just learned about this. We should do that. We should figure out how we can do this and try it in the real world. Or like, how do you register your songs with BMI? I took a publishing class. I'm like, Ryan, your songs need to be registered. You're getting like college radio play. You're like appearing on like local TV sometimes. Like, we gotta get you on BMI. And he's like, oh, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know I could make money like that. I'm like, yeah, you can. Your set lists, you can get paid for playing your own songs on stage. Pretty we gotta crazy. Do that. And it's literally just taking the concepts from class and putting it into the real world immediately was the thing that really set me up.
You know what I tell people that ask me, like, how do you break into management or what do I do? I say find local talent that you're really interested in, approach them, and see how you can have some synergy.
Absolutely. And to this day, you know, 7 years after starting managing.
Lucky number 11.
I still tell people who are interested in learning more about artist management or want to get started, or they come from other parts of the music industry and they have a wealth of experience.
But they're trying to pivot.
But they haven't ever managed anybody and they don't know if they can. I'm like, you absolutely can. You think you have to be good at everything, but you don't. You just have to know a lot about a lot of things and then get help from everyone who fills in your gaps.
And also, just most importantly, be the best advocate you could for your talent. Yes. And have some trust.
Yeah. And so you kind of have to just throw yourself at it. And I won't name names and I won't be specific, but there was a professional who I interacted with when I was in college, sort of late in college while I was interning.
Call her Sarah Palin.
Hey, sure.
Yeah.
Starting to build a network and through interning and through other relationships, meeting more senior people in the industry and getting, you know, on my way out of I had to leave Downtown Publishing because it conflicted with my last semester of college. And I had to make a choice whether to drop out of college the last semester or keep a job. And
I'm sure your parents were stoked on that.
Or quit the job and finish school and then go back in the job market, which is what I chose to do. And on my way out of that, I was doing a lot of soul searching and asking for like advice from anybody that I'd met along the way. It's like, what I really want to do is artist management. I've been managing artists sort of like informally and a little formally for the past couple of years now. I really think that's where my head's at. What advice do you have for young managers that you've ever worked with? And like, you know, what pitfalls do they constantly run into that you wish they could avoid? And this guy looked at me. He said, you really have to commit malpractice. He's a lawyer, so that was his lingo. He's like, you have to commit malpractice. Basically, you have to be willing to make huge mistakes and basically like forgive yourself for ruining somebody's options
and life.
And I'm like, this is like, I'm like gobsmacked. I'm like, how can you tell me that I need to go and ruin somebody's career options? But the truth is, like, you know, you actually have more options than you think, more chances than you think. You just have to keep going at it. Like, there's a band called Lovely the Band. Mm-hmm. It's on radio right now. And Mitchie Collins, who's the singer in that band,
Oh Honey,
was in Oh Honey.
Yep.
He was on his own thing. I've seen Mitchie go through like 3 or 4 different projects, and he's like had a couple things stick. And it just goes to show, like, if you keep trying and your product's really good,
AWOL Nation, dude, so many.
It will eventually, something can eventually crack.
I think that's a good transition to stop on, and then we can go into the next segment, malpractice to management.
Yeah.
So how can people check out what you do and who you are?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, Sam D. Tall. Tall is like not short. So you can find me there. I try to be pretty accessible because I like to help people with
art. You're the definition of accessible.
So reach out. You know, all my profiles are public for better or worse. Yikes.
For somewhere in between. So we're going to take, actually, it's not really, a week-long break. And then we'll be back with Sam Tall on Taldman's Words. I appreciate you. I appreciate this coffee. And I look forward to learning more whilst the listeners are learning more. So stick around for every single Adobe show. Until then, pull a week-long marathon and enjoy part two next week.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.